Welcome to the Thriving Birth Worker Podcast, a space for conversations about how you, the birth worker, can create not only a fulfilling and sustainable career, but a joyful and thriving life. I'm Erin Underwood, an educator, movement specialist, mother of four boys, and a total anatomy nerd. My passion is to see birth workers encouraged, supported, and empowered in their careers and life. Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the Thriving Birth Worker Podcast. I'm your host, Erin Underwood, and today I'm going to have an amazing conversation with Aniette Upke Wallace, also known as Tia. And she is a pelvic floor physical therapist. We get to dig into self-awareness and how that impacts how we serve our clients, determining if we're practicing self-care versus numbing, and of course, all things pelvic floor. A few things to be aware of. We're in January 2020 when this episode is released, and during the month of January, I'm releasing a 30-day, 5-minute movement challenge. And it's a fun way that we're playing around with incorporating a tiny bit of movement into our everyday life. I'm guiding you through day by day, just giving you one thing to practice. It takes less than 5 minutes. And if you choose to participate, a little bit or a lot, every time you participate, you get an entry into some prizes because it's supposed to be fun. So if you want to find out more, hop on over to my social media pages and come play along. It would be super fun. With our guest today, Aniette Upke Wallace, so also known as Tia, is how I refer to her during this episode. She has a lifelong fascination with the human body and its inner workings. Beginning with a formal introduction to movement in college, she's continued that journey ever since. As a yoga teacher of 8 years in the East Bay area, her practice morphed from one of structure and ego to one of humility and independent thinking. After her own struggles surrounding her pelvic floor, she has grown a love of learning and understanding this part of the body that is rarely talked about and sometimes even misunderstood. Being a mom has also introduced her to the necessary world of self-care, and she is extremely passionate on the topic of self-care being accessible and attainable. She has recently graduated with a doctorate degree in physical therapy and is in the completion stages of becoming a women's health coach through the Integrative Women's Health Institute and is also the host of the podcast, The Masterful Art of Self-Care. Now, I wanted to just bring some awareness. There's a trigger warning for today's episode. Tia is very vulnerable and shares about her own experience through miscarriage. And so if that sounds like it would not serve you today to listen to that, go ahead and skip this episode. But if that is not something that sounds too triggering for you today, then I would love to have you join us for our conversation. Hello, Tia. How are you today?
I'm doing good, Erin. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited for this conversation. I've been looking forward to it.
Awesome.
So, for our listeners who don't know you, if you could just introduce yourself, who you are, what you're doing, who you serve.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Aniette Upke Wallace, but I also go by Tia, and I am a physical therapist. Recently, I'm a new grad physical therapist, just graduated in August. I'm still fairly new in the scene, but I actually officially will be starting to practice actually next Monday at my local hospital, an outpatient setting, doing pelvic floor as well as orthopedics. And so for those who know what a physical therapist is, you know, you might be familiar, you know, like knee injury or shoulder, after having shoulder surgery, and you go to PT in order to go and rehab. So I'll be doing that, but also pelvic floor as well too, which is kind of like my passion. And everyone has a pelvic floor. And I see it as, you know, the pelvic floor is just, it's kind of the seat, you know, it's your foundation. And when that part of your body is awry or things are off, either because, you know, you're leaking pee or poop, or, you know, if you just had a baby and, you know, things don't feel right, or you're having pain with sex, so many things that can happen down there. And not a lot of people realize that there's actually help for it other than medication or surgery. A pelvic floor physical therapist can help with that. So very, very passionate about that part of the body. And so I'm excited to start working with patients in the future. And I know I'll talk about this a little bit more kind of towards the end, but I'm also a podcaster as well. And I have a podcast called The Masterful Art of Self-Care. And I can share more about that later, but that's a little bit about me.
That's awesome. So I love your passion for physical floor, pelvic floor, for physical therapy. Physical floor. It's physical too. And because I had pelvic organ prolapse. And so I get really excited about people who are just sharing hope around that topic, because I think sometimes when a woman gets a diagnosis of any kind connected to the pelvic floor, can almost feel like a nail in the coffin, like my life is over. And so I just feel like pelvic floor physical therapists are angels in disguise. I'm constantly referring out to them.
That's awesome.
Before we get into some more of what you're passionate about, I was just curious, how did you get attracted to working with the pelvic floor? I feel like most people have a personal story that's connected to it, whether it be for themselves or they saw someone else work through a recovery process. Do you, how did that draw you in?
So it's kind of a weird, I guess, story. I don't know. It started when, or at least for me to have more awareness of that part of my body, actually started when I was becoming more sexually active. And I didn't, start getting sexually active until my, probably my last year in college. And with the second partner that I was with and had a UTI, never had any issues. My periods were fairly normal. And I had a UTI, and that was like really my first like awakening to an issue down there. Obviously also the first time that I ever had sex also was like, I bled a little bit. And so that was, no one ever talks about like the first time you have sex and what to expect or anything like that. So, and also even just like the first time having sex and, it was kind of weird and awkward and a little bit painful. So for me, like those were kind of big highlights for me. But I think what kind of was the big thing was when I was in my monogamous relationship, which is with my now husband, and for, which is, really strange because I wasn't, I wasn't dating and sleeping around. I was with this, my one partner for a period of time. But now as I look back on it, I understand why it happened, but I was going through at least 3 years, back and forth of having yeast infections, bacterial infection, yeast infection, bacterial infection. I would treat one and then I'd be okay for like a week. And then, the other thing would happen. And obviously for any person who has a vulva, and has had an experience, either yeast infection or bacterial infection, how, embarrassing that is, how uncomfortable that is. And then how hard it is to bring that up to your partner, especially when your partner wants to have sex with you and you can't, because either, you have to wait until the infection clears, or because, you're doing all these suppositories for your yeast infection and you don't want things to get messy. And it was just, it was 3 years of this. And, I'm not going to go into depth, but there was also definitely a lot of emotional stuff that was also going on. And I didn't understand, I didn't understand the connection. Now I do. And that really kind of woke me up to my pelvic floor. And then me and my partner, my now husband, we got married. And, just a couple of months after getting married, I went to my OBGYN because I was ready to start a family. I wanted to have kids. And I remember her doing just a palpation around an external palpation of my my lower belly and noticed something abnormal, which was weird because I've always had, very normal pap smears and stuff. And I ended up having to go in for an ultrasound. And they found fibroids. And I was really shocked. I didn't understand why I had fibroids. I think I was in my late 20s, maybe early 30s when I discovered this. And I had three of them. And I asked, you know, how will this affect me, you know, getting pregnant, staying pregnant? And she said, like, oh, for some people, you know, might not be a big deal. But unfortunately, it was a big deal for me because I ended up getting pregnant very soon, a couple of months after I got diagnosed with having fibroids. And as my belly grew and as my baby grew, I had a really abnormal looking belly. And I didn't know what that was. Like, I thought, like, oh, it's just, you know, maybe the baby's positioned in this particular way. And wasn't until I found out that it was actually the fibroid was feeding off of all of the huge amount of hormones that was coming through my system. So that one particular fiber was getting bigger. And it got so big to the point that it was competing with space with my fetus. And I ended up miscarrying at 20 weeks. And, you know, so that was also just like a big light bulb moment for me. It was like, okay, I went through the miscarriage. I had to deliver him. They gave me Pitocin, had to deliver him, you know, so that was also kind of like a rude awakening to delivery when I wasn't prepared emotionally. It always just kind of gives me chills. Like, I remember just like I was screaming and crying and, you know, and then having to see, you know, his body come out of me and not being really ready and knowing he wasn't, you know, alive. So, you know, going through all of that. And then after, you know, spending some time to heal and really kind of coming to terms, like, I don't really know much about this part of my body. And the first book, which I had, and I had it in my bookshelf for a long time, but hadn't really actually picked up to read it, was Taking Charge of Your Fertility. And so I picked up that book, I read it cover to cover, and I started tracking my cycle. And I feel like for me, that was my first real education, my first real insight into my hormones, into my reproductive system, into, you know, my cycle and what's actually going on, and into my pelvic floor. And then from there, I think just because of the trauma of the miscarriage and just a lot of stress and other emotional things that were going on, I was starting to get some really bad pelvic floor spasms. And unfortunately, just because money and I wasn't working at the time and other issues, I didn't have the resource to go to a pelvic floor physical therapist. And at that time, I didn't know that I could go to a pelvic floor physical therapist. But I ended up, you know, seeing a body worker who worked with me and realizing I was just holding a lot of tension in my pelvic floor. And I think around that time I was doing yoga tune-up, and, you know, used one of the yoga tune-up balls, and just with me sitting on it, it really relieved a lot of the muscle spasm, and I didn't even realize just how much tension I was holding. And I feel like it was through, cause I taught yoga for, about 8 or 9 years. And during that time I found yoga tune-up. For those who don't know what that is, it's just, they use a role model method, myofascial, therapy balls in varying size. And it's a really great myofascial tool. And it was really through those tools that I really got to discover or even like uncover a lot of issues that were in my tissues, you know, specifically in my hips, you know, in my pelvic floor, just that were just so bound down. And even though I was like a yogi and I was super flexible, you know, it wasn't really true flexibility. It was more so through my joints, but not with my muscles, because my muscles were, I think, just on lockdown from having to protect and hold from the amount of flexibility that I had. So I think, like, yes, muscularly, I had a lot of tension there. And I think also just from the constant stress of, you know, the marriage that I was in and, you know, the miscarriage. And I also have two stepdaughters. And so, you know, being the stepmom, that added a lot of stress. And it was just, you know, it was a very hard time for me, but also a big awakening and growth period for me as well. So I don't know. I think, like, in a roundabout way, I'm talking about why I ended up getting into the pelvic floor. And, Yeah. So ended up just learning a lot about myself just through that book and then through using the yoga tune-up balls. And, you know, then as a yoga teacher, just realizing that, yes, I mean, yoga is great. And, but, you know, the hips and the pelvic floor. And I feel like at that time, I mean, this was like in 2019 and I was teaching like started in 2007. Not a lot of people were talking about that particular part of the body, you know, aside from like in pregnancy, like not in pregnancy, just like for the general population. And so that really piqued my interest. Then I got pregnant again. I had the fibroids. I ended up having to, in order for me to get pregnant and have a viable pregnancy, I had to have a laparoscopic myomectomy, so a non-invasive surgery in order to remove the fibroids. So that was my first. It wasn't a major abdominal surgery, but it was an abdominal surgery where there were small incisions made in my abdomen. And so that created some issues, at least core strength wise. And then because I got pregnant very soon after that surgery, I had to get a scheduled C-section because they wanted to decrease the chance of my uterus rupturing if I went into labor. So I ended up having a major abdominal surgery. And despite having a C-section, I still was having, you know, muscle spasms. So I think the myth that like if you have a C-section, then you're not going to have any pelvic floor dysfunction, I think is really untrue because I did already have underlying pelvic floor dysfunction. And, you know, just with having the C-section and, you know, the doctor pulling the baby out, that also, you know, puts a lot of strain and tension on the uterine muscles as well. And I wasn't ever actually like diagnosed, but I know I have like some level of prolapse as well too. It's not very significant, but when I'm with my daughter and jumping on the trampoline for a long period of time, I will get a little bit of leakage. But otherwise, like during the course of my day, I don't. But under like a lot of high impact jumping, I will. So, yeah, I mean, just like all of that, I guess it's like almost a span of like 12, 15 years of stuff. And when I feel like that I've really uncovered and, you know, other than just like the physical aspect, when I really dealt with a lot of other underlying emotional issues, mental issues that I was not willing to discover or really go into depth, you know, in the past, I felt that that really helped a lot with some of my pelvic floor stuff. So I love that. I love this part of the body. Everybody has one from, you know, the moment that you are a little kid and you're potty trained, you know, even just that, whether you're forced to be potty trained because your parents don't want to have to deal with diapers, you know, up to the moment that you're old and you're an elder and, you know, having to deal with incontinence issues, you know, it's something that is always going to be a part of your life and that can have such a huge impact on the quality of your life. So, and I've seen that, you know, just, doing some clinical rotations at a skilled nursing facility. And I mean, that's one of the biggest, causes for elderly folks going into a nursing home is because of incontinence issues. And that shouldn't be the case, you know? So, it's so multifaceted. It affects everybody. So I feel if I can at least be one other person who can at least help address these issues, I want to be that person.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing so vulnerably. That was powerful. And especially around the miscarriage and even just talking about yeast infections, like, there's so many things we all have experienced, but then there's this shame around talking about it. And totally. So I think it's really powerful to just be able to put it on the table. And I love asking the question to pelvic floor practitioners, because I think there is a level of shame and I see some resistance sometimes with women wanting to go to a pelvic floor practitioner, whether it be a PT or a OT or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I love just highlighting the compassion that draws people to that field so that it adds that level of safety of, okay, most people go into this field because they have their own story and they understand it's not such a cold, sterile, and compassionate environment. It's definitely usually a very, very positive experience and empowering experience for someone to walk into that office and say, okay, let's talk, let's get real, let me tell you what's really going on. And and to get some hope spoken over them of, okay, you have options. These are things we can do. These are different ways, things we can explore, different tools we can use.
Definitely.
So to transition, you have a podcast called The Masterful Art of Self-Care. So clearly you are passionate around the subject of self-care. So I was thinking today we could process more around this idea of self-care. What is self-care? What drew you to that area of work? And specifically diving into, as a practitioner who works with people, so we're talking to birth workers, you know, we'll just get into all of it. So,
okay, sure.
So how would you, let's just start by defining self-care. How would you define it?
I mean, I would define self-care as a tool, or I'm going to say like a method, but like a tool that allows for more space, that allows for more freedom, in order to be your true self in a way. I don't have like a really nice definition, because I feel like sometimes my definition of self-care just kind of, it changes, it varies, depending on what it is that I need. And sometimes it could be like, you know, I'm just super stressed out and, you know, being with my daughter and, you know, I need a time out for myself, and the self-care, you know, thing that I need at that moment is for me to, you know, either go in another room and take a nap, you know, and just have her play on her own. Or other times, you know, especially if I'm, you know, feeling stress and I'm taking some of my stress out on my daughter, and then I realize like I'm getting disconnected, you know, she's getting mad at me, I'm getting mad at her. Instead of me walking away, like maybe we just need to just take an hour or even 30 minutes and just play, you know, either I play a game with her, or, you know, we do something together, or we just sit on the couch and, you know, we have this little game called like, you know, ants and or Mike, ladybugs and caterpillars, you know, and I pretend to be like a caterpillar, and, you know, we do that. And so in a way, like I still get, you know, that touch, you know, we both get that touch, you know, with each other. And then it's a way for us to also play and also just connect with each other. And that can also be self-care. So I unfortunately, I don't have like a very clear definition, but I think, you know, it's whatever it is that you need at that moment that can shift, again, depending on your environment and who you're with, that is going to allow you to care for yourself in the best way possible.
Mm-hmm.
I guess would be my definition. It's not
that's good. I love how you say it's always shifting too, because I think it is, as we grow and as we, it depends on the situation and where we're at emotionally and what's going on in our day, that it can shift. It's not as static. And for me personally, one of the things I think sometimes knowing what something is, it's helpful to kind of know what it's not. And in my own life, when I'm processing, it's, I delineate between numbing and self-care. So I just kind of ask myself, because even the very same act can sometimes be a numbing act, or sometimes it can actually refill me. And so even like the idea of like vegging out on Netflix, it's like some days I'm like, this is an escape mechanism.
Yeah.
This is me numbing out. And when I'm done, I will probably feel worse than better. And some days, like after I like veg out on Netflix, I'm like, oh, that's exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
So I think it's, for me, that's one of the ways that I choose to look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and I know like I'm a big proponent of making self-care individual, but I also don't want to like demonize and say like, oh, you shouldn't, you know, binge out on Netflix or have ice cream or, you know, take a bubble bath. Cause I think all of those are great. Cause when I do have the opportunity to, you know, actually take a bath, then like, I'm going to luxuriate in that. I'm going to love that. And, you know, I rarely watch because I was a grad student for so long. And so when I do have the opportunity to go and like watch a movie on Netflix, like, yes, I get to watch a movie, because I haven't like done that just because in such a long time. So I enjoy that. So I definitely, you know, I don't want to say that doing those things are bad, because sometimes, yes, they are needed. But I think, as you stated, I think having that awareness is so key, of knowing I'm just numbing my feelings so I don't have to deal with, you know, the shit that I know I need to face, or, you know, it's something like, yes, I know that I need this. And I know my sister, I'm going to call her out, but, you know, and she, you know, and she's going through a lot of stuff right now. And, you know, she'll have like a Saturday where there's, you know, things that she wants to do towards her side hustle, but then, you know, she'll sleep for a little bit longer than she wanted to. And then she makes herself feel really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And like, no, don't feel bad. Like your body told you that you needed to have more sleep. So have more sleep, you know, or your body said like, I need to just, you know, veg out. I need to just chill out because you've been going, you know, 5 days a week, you know, for, you know, 10 hours a day, 10, 12 hours a day at work. It's okay to just, you know, veg out. If that's like, if you're being aware and you know, okay, this is something that I need to do, especially if your body's giving you that signal, like you need to slow down instead of like, okay, going on to the next task, because this is what I truly want to do. And this is supposed to be my self-care and it's supposed to make me feel really good. Sometimes you could just be just sitting there and just like doing nothing. And I think that could be self-care too. It doesn't always have to be about doing something. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really having that clear understanding. Again, noticing, you know, am I numbing my feelings and doing this particular self-care in order to numb and avoid? Or am I doing it because it's actually going to fulfill me? Or it's because my body is telling me I need to slow down or I need to stop doing so much. And maybe I just need to just relax and just not do anything. So I think having those really clear definitions and being aware is the biggest thing that people need to realize.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we talk about a subject and then we realize we need to take it back a step to actually be able to approach it with a helpful perspective.
Yes.
So I think when we talk about self-care, a lot of it is taking a step back and digging into self-awareness. And you talk about this on your blog of just kind of digging into maybe like what is self-awareness and how do you cultivate it? Like when we're in such a society, I think, where it's so go, 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 and it's so busy and it's so checklist. And we're just, you know, trying to almost constantly put out fires and mm-hmm. do the right thing, that this idea of self-awareness, I think, sometimes can get lost in the process.
Yeah.
So how do you approach self-awareness?
I approach self-awareness, I think, through my meditation practice, I think is big, and also through journaling. I think through both of those practices, they've allowed me just to be more self-aware. And both of those are things that I do, you know, first thing in the morning. And it's great because, and this is part of my self-care, you know, routine, my morning routine, is that, you know, after I do my movement practice and I meditate for 5 minutes, and that's just enough time that I need. But for me to just reflect on, okay, like, where's my mind today? You know, is it like, am I just kind of like bouncing a lot of ideas in my head? Am I, you know, feeling really content and like I can, you know, notice just where my body is at that moment? Or, you know, or am I just running off like a bunch of checklists or things that I need to do? And so for me, just my meditation practice, and it might not be like what I wanted it to be, of it being like totally zen and all I'm doing is focusing on my breath, is like I realize, okay, if I need to keep refocusing, then there's a lot of things going on in my life or in that particular day or emotional, mental things that might be happening that obviously I need to address and I need to focus on. So I feel like that helps a lot. And then also just me journaling, and you know, it's you know, I have both a gratitude journal and then just my intentional journal, where I just write, you know, what is my physical status today? You know, what's my emotional status today? What are my intentions for today? And I like doing that, just because it's a chance for me to really check in, like, okay, how is my body really feeling, you know, before I go into the day, so that I can put out that intention, like, okay, you know, I might be on my cycle. My body's feeling a little low energy. Okay, I need to just kind of slow down. I need to simplify a little bit. Maybe all the things that I had on my calendar to do today, it probably is not going to happen. And I'm okay with that, and not beat myself up, you know, for not getting it done. So I like that like little check-in, and for me to just be really honest and true to where I am at that moment. So that way, as I go through my day, you know, I just set that intention of where I want to be, or really honor where I am. I think that answers your question. Yeah, just with regards to self-awareness. So I feel like those are really big things. And I mean, I think like just also being a mother, I think, you know, you end up learning a little bit more to be more self-aware. I don't know. I could say for myself, you know, because it's different energy. Like when my daughter's in school right now. And so I feel like I'm a different person. And, you know, I have my time at home and I get to do the things that I want to do and have my tea and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I pick up my daughter, it's a different energy, you know, and I sense mm-hmm. that. And I realize, okay, like I have to shift, you know, to her energy. And especially there's moments where like, I want to just kind of be, you know, really chill and low key. And she's like hyper and she wants to play. And I don't, and that we end up not vibing. And I sense that and I notice that. And I don't like then, you know, that I want to kind of impart how I'm feeling towards her. And I'll pick up on that. And it's like, okay, well, I need to do something. Either we go outside or we do something that, you know, can meet both of our energy levels at the same time. And I think, you know, being self-aware moment to moment is also just as important, you know, whether it's interacting, you know, with your friend or your partner or your kids. And I feel like at least for me, doing that intention setting, the journaling, the meditation really helps me to kind of tune into that. And I've been doing that for a while, so I feel like it's gotten easier. And it might be different for everybody, but at least that's what's been working for me.
That's awesome. So I love what you were saying about, you know, just making the time and prioritizing it. But then there's that flip side of the coin as far as like, you just finished grad school, you're yeah. a mom, you're a partner, like you have so many plates that you're juggling. So there's this really crazy dichotomy of, it feels like when we need self-care the most, we have the least amount of time for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so like processing, approaching that without like making excuses, but without like guilting ourselves or shaming ourselves around mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
And like having that expectations. How did you, especially in that really intense time of your life, walk that tightrope?
I think, well, because I knew that, especially going through grad school and having, you know, my daughter's 5 now, and I started before she even turned 1. And, you know, I think like first, I think is asking for help. So I feel like that was the biggest. And be like, even if you're just a grad student on your own, you need to have help. Absolutely. So I think that is the biggest lesson that I've learned from self-care is being okay with asking for help. So whether that was, you know, from my partner to help watch my daughter so I can study, or, you know, having my friends, you know, watch my daughter so I could study. My parents, my sisters, they helped me out, you know, whether it's financially or just being an emotional cheerleader, because I needed to have someone, you know, pep me up when I was going through those hard classes and having to take exams. And the school that I went to, I had to travel twice a month. I live in the Bay Area, so I had to travel down to San Diego twice a month. And I did that for about 4 years. So that was a lot as well. And I feel there's something that was that I wanted to say. It'll come back to me. But I feel like that was really big in regards to, you know, making sure that I was instilling some self-care. I'm not going to say that it was perfect, because it really wasn't until maybe my third or almost last year of grad school that I really started to hone in, or like, okay, I needed to make time for myself. And one of the things that I feel like you mentioned, that when you realize that you don't have time for self-care is when you actually need it the most. And what I realized is like, I have the time. It's just, I need to reprioritize and I need to make the time in order to do this. And when I actually looked at how I spent my day, like, yes, I was spending, you know, some time to study, but also, you know, and I was obviously with my daughter as well. But then during the times that I wasn't studying, you know, I was on my phone or, I, you know, just on my computer and on Facebook or Instagram, or just not, it was time. I mean, it was time wasted, and it was time that I could either be reading a book or I could, you know, I was complaining about like not exercising, you know, I could, you know, do something. And not to say that, you know, there's always going to be excuses and you can always fill up that time. And that's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to then fill up that time with more stuff. I think that I realized I needed to simplify. Like I want to simplify my life so that I can make space for the things that are important to me and that are of value for me. And being a type A person, I realized that there's always like the next course and the next thing and the next, you know, webinar and, you know, all of this stuff. And it's exciting and I love learning. But at the end of the day, and it's really just, I feel like in the last year that I've really come to terms with this is like, I need to stop wasting money, you know, on courses, and I just need to start practicing. And I also need to stop wasting this time on, you know, all these things that I want to do, or, you know, these courses that I want to travel. And actually, I want to travel just for fun. I want to be able to travel with my daughter because that's going to provide me more value. And that I wanted to simplify my life a lot more. And when I realized that I could, instead of, you know, putting on more tasks on my plate, sorry about that. I don't know if you heard. It was just a coffee machine. Okay. So when I realized, like, instead of putting more tasks on my calendar, and when I actually took, you know, things off, then it actually made it easier. Like, okay, then I can actually go to bed by 10 o'clock, or I can actually turn off my phone, close my computer at 10 o'clock. I can read for 30 minutes and be in bed by 10:30, which then allowed me to have enough sleep to then get up at 5:30 in the morning and have an hour and 15 minute self-care morning routine so that I have that me time for myself in the morning, and I get to move and I get to do yoga or do my strength training and journal and meditate and, you know, read my personal development book and do all of that before I have to wake my daughter up to get ready for school. And that was huge. Like, that was huge when I gave myself that time. I took that time back. And then also realizing like a lot of the stuff that I was doing at night wasn't really fulfilling me. And I wasn't my most creative at nighttime, you know, because I was already tired. So why don't I just shift all of that to the morning time when I actually have a lot more energy? And then at nighttime, that's when I can actually spend time with my husband and, you know, we can just talk, or I can just read, or I can, you know, meditate, or I can, you know, do a really slow yoga practice. And then like, then I'm able to find those pockets of time to actually do my self-care instead of feeling like, oh, it's a big chore and I have to schedule it in. It's just, I took things off of my plate that really weren't serving me and that were just filling up time for me, and it wasn't of a real purpose. And I felt that that made it I was able to then be able to, you know, integrate self-care more easily into my life. And then, you know, it's become, I feel like, a lot easier. So, I mean, right now, like my motto lately has been like, simplify. I need to just simplify, because if I want to be able to bring more things into my life, more good things, like I need to simplify. I need to like not stress over doing more things. Like I just need to be really good at what I'm doing right now and just get solid in that. And, you know, then from there I can be able to have open it more time to do more things if I want to. You know, I like that I at least will have that choice rather than feeling like I need to do it. I prefer that I have the choice if I want to do it.
Yeah, that's good. I love how you phrased it. As you said, you were giving yourself that time. So yeah. I think it's that flipping it around in our head, because I think sometimes, oh, I have to wake up early, or I have to do this.
Yes.
And almost feels like you're, you know, putting yourself in a position of like having to do it versus like, I'm giving myself this gift. Like I'm choosing to give this to myself. That's awesome. So
yeah,
as a grad student, I'm probably convinced you're connected and have experienced a little bit of this idea of burnout.
Yeah.
And
yes,
maybe a little bit. And I know a lot of birth workers experience at some point in their career, they kind of hit this wall, this mm-hmm. burnout experience, because it's an emotional and it's a physical, and it's there's the idea of being on call all the time. There's just a lot of factors that add into this feeling of burnout. So mm-hmm. can we talk about burnout for a minute? How through, because, you know, through self-care, through self-awareness, or whatever other tools that you used, did mm-hmm. you process this burnout?
Yeah. So, I mean, as a grad student, I was definitely had a lot of burnout. And I would say that during the course of my time in grad school, I didn't have too much of it, because I felt, you know, I did a pretty good job of not taking on too much, except for the year that I decided to be a, you know, obviously be a mom to a toddler. I think she was 2 or 3 years old at the time, grad school. And I decided I want to go back to work. And wow. I decided to work part-time at a PT clinic because I wanted to get more experience. So that was when that was the year that I actually I really suffered a lot of burnout, and I actually was getting, my body was sensing that this was not good, because I was starting to get really bad heart palpitations during that year. And a lot of it was just having that awareness, like, okay, things aren't right, and just starting to say no. Like, I ended up having to quit, you know, probably 9 or 10 months into that job, because it was just too much. So saying no, I think, is the biggest, mm-hmm. You know, and it's kind of in alignment with, you know, what I mentioned about giving yourself that time. And it's also just about saying no. And, you know, so then, at least in regards to your question with, you know, birth workers, and I think, you know, really with any healthcare professional, especially for those who are just very passionate and very devoted and into their craft and into their career, that you give so much of yourself into what it is that you're doing. And I know, you know, some doulas and birth workers who, you know, especially as a doula, I did like a very, very short stint of being a doula, and like being up for very long hours and having to mother and be that supportive person, that advocate for that mother, and how draining that can really be. And then doing that, you know, on and on and on. And I think I'm trying to think, like, what's the best way to say this, but I feel like the biggest is it's realizing just, you know, this is the field that you're going into, and that these are some of the expectations that you might be giving yourself, and to realize that some of those expectations of, you know, doing, you know, having 3 doula clients or having 4 doula clients like in a month might be too much, you know, and scaling it back. That I think that you're making sure that you are, you know, especially on those off times when you're not working with a client, that you are giving yourself that downtime, maybe even away from any type of, you know, doula stuff. And I think, again, you know, when I, because I did a little bit of doula stuff, and even just as a PT for me, it's like, I'm consuming, everything is PT, PT, PT. Like, when I'm cooking dinner, I'm listening to, you know, a webinar about PT. When I'm in the car, I'm listening to a podcast about PT, and you're just constantly consuming, you know, everything in regards to your craft. And I think that can also be like such overwhelm. And I'm going to say it can lead to burnout, but like, I, you know, if it's part of your self-care is to like go for a walk, you know, or to, you know, take a class, that maybe it's something that's totally separate, doesn't have anything to do with your work, I think is important. Yeah, because I think burnout is definitely, it's a big prevalent thing. And I know, at least in the PT world, it's a big thing. And I know it is, you know, also for birth workers as well. But right, I mean, I can say for myself right now, I'm not experiencing that. But when I was, just during that 3rd or 4th year of grad school, being able to step away from doing so much of that and, you know, going in a different direction so that my whole 24/7 wasn't consumed with physical therapy. I think that contributed to my burnout, because that's all that I was pretty much doing other than, you know, being a mom and being a housewife. But it was like either that or physical therapy, and being able to either say no and just, you know, take that one thing away, or being able to, integrate something else that wasn't related to my work or related to school and have that, you know, be, you know, my self-care practice or my self-care routine, I think was really, really helpful for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. So I'm glad you're not experiencing burnout now, which is awesome. And I love those tips of like, learning to say no, the awareness, the listening to your body, even when your body's giving you those clues of, like you said, the heart palpitations of like, okay, my body is talking to me. Even if my brain thinks I can handle this, my body is giving me some signals here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So and also, go ahead. As I mentioned, so next week is when I'm actually starting, you know, full time. And I think that I'm going into now a new full time work setting. And now that I have experienced burnout and I know what it feels like, and for me to make sure that I also set boundaries, I think is really important. So especially going into whether it's a new setting or working with, you know, a new patient and a new client, I think boundaries also is another thing to make sure that you are doing. And I'm hoping that as I enter into, you know, this new environment, that's going to be huge in order for me to make sure that I don't experience burnout at this clinic setting that I'm going into. You know, so whether it's saying no to working extra hours, you know, whether it's saying no to working with someone who might, you know, push my buttons or who I know is going to mentally, emotionally take up, you know, I'm going to say take up my time, but, you know, where I'd be like emotionally or mentally investing so much energy into that person that I know it's not going to serve me. So I think also setting boundaries are also a really huge thing. And I think, and definitely, I mean, as birth workers, you know, being so empathetic and wanting to be supportive and, you know, be that cheerleader and, you know, be that advocate and be everything for your client and realizing that there's only so much that you can give and how much do you really want to invest of yourself, like even physically of yourself, do you really want to invest? Because then that relationship, you know, yes, it's for that short duration of time, you know, whether it's, you know, for a couple of months and maybe it might continue on, you know, again in the future, but how much do you want to sacrifice of that? That then you end up depleting yourself. I don't think that there has to be a harmonious balance. Mm-hmm. So, and it's going to, again, you know, based on that person and how they work with their client, you know, that's something that they have to, I think, determine at the onset, you know, at the beginning, and see how it is that they want to work with them. Because if they don't establish those boundaries, if they don't have that intention of, or at the outset, you know, those intentions of how they want to work with each other, then I think that that is a recipe, you know, for burnout for sure. If they're not being very, very clear with, you know, how much they want to invest of themselves.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a perfect transition to my last question before we wrap up here is you were talking about boundaries. And then I just wanted to dial in real specific on emotional boundaries. So when you're in the clinic and you're working with people who are in pain and they may be in a place of frustration or they may be in a place of feeling stuck or really discouraged, and you are in this field because you care about your clients and you want to see them walk out with hope. You want to see them walk out feeling better. And there's some days where that might not be their reality at this very moment. How do you process those emotional boundaries of not picking up, like still being an empath, still caring, but not picking up what isn't yours to carry emotionally?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest that I've learned is that I can't care about, you know, their particular condition as much as they do. So I can't be the person who's like, I want you to get better. I want you to heal. I want you to not be in pain. And if it's not the same energy that I'm getting from them, I can't care more than they do. So otherwise, again, it just comes back to like, I'm going to be investing so much of my time and my energy into doing everything that I can to make sure that they're not in pain. But then if they're not carrying that same, if they're not caring as much, then why should I be spending so much of my time, my energy, doing the same thing? And I feel like that when I was able to realize that, I felt that that made it, it created the boundary that I needed, because there were times, and I have to use my mother as an example, you know, and that she is someone right now who is experiencing chronic pain, and she is someone who actually is going to PT right now. But for a while I was, you know, she's in New York, I'm in California. Whenever I went to New York, you know, she was like my patient. I was helping her. And yeah, I mean, with a person who is experiencing pain, you know, there's so much more than just the physical part. A lot of it is definitely the emotional part. And yes, I mean, I am a very empathetic person, but there comes a point where there's only so much handholding that you can do with a person, that, you know, if they're not willing to then take that next step, you know, in order to, you know, seek out help or go to a PT or make that appointment or get that test done or actually do the exercise, you know, whatever it is, I can't help them. You know, I can't make them do the exercise. I can't, you know, make them go to their doctor and, you know, get a second opinion or go get that test or go to a PT or make sure that they get their next appointment. I can make all of those recommendations and I can tell them, you know, why it's going to benefit them. But I can't make them do it. So I think imparting when I'm working, you know, with a patient, you know, imparting and letting them know, like a lot of it, I feel like is the education piece. It's not like, I want you to do this because like your doctor said, you have to come in, you know, twice a week for, you know, 2 months or whatever that is. But I think providing that education, letting them know, okay, like this is how long it's going to take. You know, you're going to be, when we do some of these exercises, it might bring on some of the pain, but understand, you know, what the healing process is like. And I think having that conversation with the patient so they have that understanding of what to expect, I think is important. So that way, a lot of that, the process of that healing journey is, it's in their hands as well, too. Because I never ever want to, you know, be seen as I'm the healer, like I'm your healer, or I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to be called like doctor. You know, yes, I am a doctor. I received this doctorate. You know, a lot of it is for the information, the knowledge that I received. But I never want to be perceived as like, I'm your healer. You know, a lot of the work that I'm going to be doing with the patient, it's a two-way street. Like I'm going to give you some information and I'm going to help you do these exercises, you know, and provide manual therapy, do some hands-on stuff. But then it's also an expectation that you're going to do some of the work. You have to put in the work in order to make sure that you get the outcome that you're expecting or that you want. And I feel that when I have been able to do that, I am able to go home and not carry a lot of this stuff with me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, when it's my mom, it's my mother. So, you know, it's a very different type of relationship. And I think that's why it was good that she is seeing a PT who is not me, because that would be really, really hard. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd want to like have a long-term patient-client or patient healthcare practitioner relationship, you know, with my sibling or with my parents, because that's just too many emotions there. But I think with anybody else, it makes it just kind of like a really clear boundaries, clear delineation of, you know, this is the expectation that I have of you. And it makes it much easier for me to not, you know, take some of the stuff home with me. I mean, I empathize absolutely. But like at the end of the day, like I also have to think of my own, I'm going to say my own sanity, but I have to take care of myself. Like, I don't want to take on all of the heartache and, you know, everything that I hear. Cause I'm also I need to take care of myself too. And for me to, you know, and I need to be present, you know, I need to be the strong person. I need to be the one to give them the answers, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what they're expecting of me too, when they're coming into my office, is that they're expecting that I'm going to be the strong person, you know, I'm going to, yes, be there to, you know, hold their hand and to listen to them and to be empathetic and to help them. But I can't be on the same level, you know, if they're emotional or that I'm emotional, because that just, it's not a good working relationship. So,
yeah. Well, I think that's a really powerful place to wrap things up, it was a really, it's a really good reminder of like, we're called to carry, not necessarily to carry, we're called to connect. We're called to connect with our clients, but not to carry their load for them.
Yes.
And that balance and delineation, I think, is really powerful. I think you summarized that really well.
Yeah.
So for our listeners who would want to connect with you more, where can they find you?
Yeah. So I have a website. It's called themasterfulartofselfcare.com. And that's where you can find my podcast as well as my blog. And I don't do newsletters all that often, but where you can at least connect with me if you do have any questions. I am on Instagram. So I talked about simplifying my life. So Instagram is the only social media that I'm using right now that I like and that I'm pretty much just going to stick with for right now. And my Instagram handle is @selfcarephysio. So you can find me there. And I'm located in the Bay Area in Oakland. So if you are local to the area, then you can definitely reach out. Yeah, that's about it.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for sharing with us today, Tia.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much, Erin, for having me.
I just love that conversation. Smart people who lean into their intuitive side are some of my favorites to talk to. To support today's podcast, I've created a self-care journaling practice. It's a guided journaling practice that helps you assess your own beliefs around self-care and helps you define what will serve you in those moments of stress or exhaustion. All the links can be found in today's episode show notes at thrivingbirthworker.com under the podcast link episode 8. If you're wanting to make sure you don't miss out on any of the next episodes coming up, and trust me, they're super good, especially next week's, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And as always, reviews and ratings are so very much appreciated. I'm so grateful for you and for you giving me a piece of your precious time and for the incredible service you provide to the beautiful birthing community. If you want to chat with me directly about anything, really, you can always DM me on social media or email me directly. I hope you all have a wonderful week, and I look forward to connecting with you soon. The information and discussion provided on this podcast are not intended and should not be construed as medical advice. If you have a medical concern, you should consult with an appropriately licensed physician or healthcare provider.